Hi, this is Robert Shearer with another edition of Shearer Intelligence. And the intelligence today is coming from John Wiener, who, along with Mike Davis, has written an incredible book called Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s. And when I say incredible, it's just the definitive work on what L.A. was like during what you ever want to call it, the Beat Movement, the anti-war movement, the whole whatever happened in the 60s happened in L.A. in a very important way, not only because L.A. is an important city, certainly maybe the arguably the most important city and region in the country, but also because it's their center of music and entertainment and movie making and myth making and television and everything. And so setting the night on fire in Los Angeles reverberated around the world even more profoundly. And I say this with the conceit of somebody who was in Berkeley in those days, mostly, much more so than anywhere else, including New York. Mike Davis is, of course, the legendary historian, writer about this area. He wrote the most important book, The City of Quartz. And my guest today is his co-author, John Wiener, who is a highly regarded professor of history, now emeritus, which means he has time to think anew, and at University of California, Irvine. And I have used John's work a lot in my own teaching and writing, but one in particular is a movie called Give Me Some Truth, the John Lennon FBI file. And what John did was get the records of really how the U.S. government, we now talk about all kinds of foreign governments doing terrible things to us, but the most terrible things have done to us by our own government. And John Lennon was not one of our citizens, but the attempt of the FBI to destroy John Lennon doesn't quite rise to the level of trying to destroy Martin Luther King, which is well documented. But that was a work that first that I've relied on heavily in my teaching. But let me begin, and I'll get you to talk about John Lennon, the FBI. But this new book, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s, and I'm not saying this with any hostility. No, because I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot about it. But my goodness, it's an 800-page book. And I have to ask you, what were you and Mike, what were you guys thinking? An 800-page book on something that happened a half century ago. So why don't we just begin? Why should anybody pick up this tome, let alone purchase it? What's the price? $35, you know, and it's by Verso Press. And this is my way of actually celebrating this book. I found it marvelous. Really, I found it great in the detail. I just loved it. And I probably have to spend the rest of what remains in my life to fully absorb it. But really, what caused you guys to set the record straight on the 60s in LA?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you, Bob. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you on one of my favorite podcasts. But I have to say, you've exaggerated a bit. It's true there are 800 pages in the book, but only 640 pages of text. The rest is notes, bibliography, index. So it's 640 is a much more reasonable.
I got a goddamn hernia picking up this book. What are you talking about? It's at least 3.5 inches thick, isn't it?
It's big. Look, it's big. You know,
it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. And I noticed a lot of bigger books are coming out now. I don't know if that's because they don't actually sell print copies. People get them by ebooks or what have you. And maybe, I don't know, was this printed in China or someplace? Maybe the cost of production has gone way down. But come on, you could devote your whole life to this book. Yeah.
I appreciate your sentiments here, but, you know, we feel it's too short. We feel we had to leave out so many important things that we're just heartbroken over. But our publisher said that we were already testing the limits of binding technology and we had to call it quits. So we even had to cut a couple of chapters. It's been a very painful process to make this book as short as it is.
Okay, but let me put a question seriously to you, because you are really two guys who've contributed a great deal. Mike Davis, I'm sure a lot of people know his name, and John Wiener, and you made a conscious decision to set the record straight on L.A. in the 60s, set the night on fire. Why that decision? And tell us, really, take it from here. What is the result of your research and your writing?
Well, I want to give Mike Davis credit. This is basically his conception. You know, you mentioned City of Quartz. After City of Quartz, you know, I've taught City of Quartz for probably a dozen different years to grad seminars, and the smart students all have the same criticism. This is a great book, but it's all about the elites and the ideologies. Where are the people? Where are the people? And Mike wanted to write a book about what we call, we say our heroes are the working class young people of the great flatlands of Los Angeles. This is not about the movies. It's not about surf culture. It's not about rock and roll or the, you know, scene in Hollywood or in the canyons. The core of this book is a chronological narrative of Black and Latino organizing and struggle. It's a movement history that starts in 1960 when young Black people in LA were inspired, like you and I were, by the civil rights movement in the South, by the sit-in movement and the Freedom Riders. That's the spine of the book. And then around that, we discuss all the other movements of the era, the anti-war movement, the women's liberation movement, the gay liberation movement, the Asian American movement appears at the very end, the counterculture that helped build and supported all these movements, especially KPFK and the LA Free Press. The LA Free Press was the largest so-called underground newspaper of the 60s, the most successful, edited by Art Kunkin. So, and LA also had a free clinic, one of the second free clinic in America. The first, of course, was San Francisco, which pioneered the idea that there's a right to healthcare, that healthcare should be free in America. So to tell that story takes a lot of pages. But we said no one else is ever going to do this after we do it. So we have to make sure we do it right.
Yeah. So tell us what you did, really. What's the takeaway?
So, you know, first of all, we see the movements that we think of as the 60s. LA kind of disproves a lot of the conventional wisdom on this. We think of the anti-war movement as basically something that took place on the college campuses, first of the Ivy League of Columbia and Harvard, and then of the big public universities, Berkeley, where you were such an important person, Wisconsin, Michigan. In LA, this was not the case. LA is the great exception. In LA, it's the state colleges and the community colleges. In fact, it was at Valley State, a brand new college. Now it's called Cal State's Northridge. Then it was Valley State. It had just been founded. They had a huge Black studies movement that seized the president's office, and that led to the largest number of felony charges against student radicals anywhere in the United States. 24 members of the Black Students Union at Valley State were charged with 1,730 felonies. Didn't happen anywhere else. So the student movement here is very different. And our feeling is, our discovery is that the movement in LA, and this actually surprised me, I have to say, I was surprised by how young the activists in the streets were. They weren't just college students. They were high school students. In some cases, they were even junior high students. And that may be the case everywhere else, but we documented it very thoroughly here in LA. LA also had was distinguished by a place where the old left and the new left were not antagonistic, were had some very important connections and ties. And this was mostly because of one person, Dorothy Healy, who was the head of the Communist Party of Southern California, always a kind of dissident, sometimes renegade, always fighting with the National Party over the party line. And Dorothy, first of all, thought the communists should be open and public about their beliefs. She had a show on KPFK called Communist Commentary that started in 1959, unheard of in the rest of American media, mainstream media especially. And she cultivated, developed, paid attention to, and instructed, and was the kind of mentor to a whole generation of activists, which included, first of all, Mike Davis. He joined because of Dorothy. And second of all, the most famous radical of the 60s, Angela Davis, was a kind of protege of Dorothy Healy, and Dorothy was her mentor through all of her struggles at the end of the 60s. So this is a place where, and also Art Kunkin, founder of the LA Free Press, he'd been an editor, he was older, and older than the college kids. He had edited, worked on the SWP newspaper, and on community newspapers in East L.A.
SWP is the Socialist Workers Party. Which was, for people who don't know all this history, was opposite to the Communist Party on the left. They were a Trotskyist or ite group. I never got that distinction clear. But they were, after all, they accused the communists of killing Leon Trotsky, their hero in Mexico, right?
So, which was true.
So you're describing, yes, there were elements of the old left, but the old left was not monolithic.
It
was
right.
Had many different components, and they knew each other's failings. So this was not a naive culture of young people swept up in some sectarian movement, because the debate within the old left was very strong, and that carried. You're right. They got along well, precisely because there was such an open LA-ish environment.
And how has it been? How have we managed to spend 10 minutes without ever mentioning the LAPD, which of course has so prominently been in the news in this summer, along with all the other police departments of the country? The LAPD provides, I'm sorry to say, the kind of unifying thread that they're present in almost every chapter of our book, because they set out to attack, undermine, and destroy almost every movement in our book, including some of the more unlikely ones. I mean, we know how they set out to and succeeded with the help of the FBI in destroying the Black Panther Party. That was COINTELPRO. That's a story that is very well known about how the FBI secretly fomented a murderous rivalry between the Panthers and the organization headed by Ron Karenga called US. But the FBI, and of course, we know how it targeted the anti-war movement. That's a well-known story. What's a little less well-known is the FBI went after the women's movement here in LA. LA had one of the very first women's self-help health clinics on South Crenshaw. This was the era when the book Our Bodies, Ourselves had just been published. The old timers out there will certainly remember Our Bodies, Ourselves, a kind of a pioneering revolutionary book declaring independence from the medical profession as it then existed. The LAPD raided the women's self-help clinic on South Crenshaw and arrested activists there and charged them with practicing medicine without a license. Carol Downer was put on trial. Her crime had been recommending yogurt for the treatment of vaginal yeast infections. So this was called the Great Yogurt Conspiracy by the rest of the women's movement. It became a national a national event. Of course, she was found innocent in the end, but the LAPD had set out to destroy the women's health movement. The one exception, I never quite figured out why, was the free clinic. The free clinic was okay with the LAPD. They didn't raid it. They didn't try to
I'll give you the answer to that one.
Please.
I think I'm a bit older than you. A
little bit.
I was on the scene. So you know why it goes to the current crisis in Los Angeles right now regarding homeless people? And what the establishment loved, whether you call them the Salvation Army or you call it the L.A. Free Clinic or whoever, they love people who come and feed the homeless.
Yeah.
As long as the homeless are not in the pristine neighborhoods, as long as they're located in some place where the rest of the voters won't encounter them. And so the Berkeley Flea Clinic was also such a group. They were seen as sort of do-gooders, you know, and even though what they were really challenging was the whole medical system, which resonates again today.
Yes.
They were even celebrated as, okay, you take care of those homeless people and very poor people and people who are neglected by the medical system. You're kind of doing our dirty work. But I want to pick up on what you said about the police, and I do want to bring it right up to the present, right now. Because what happened was, in Los Angeles, thanks to the movie industry, you actually had a celebration of the police, all sorts of shows, movies, TV, and everything. And it was very convenient to shoot here in LA. So a whole mythology developed about a very effective, wonderful police force and sheriff's department and everything else. And the fact is, it was a deeply racist, anti-union for the big corporations led by the Los Angeles Times, where they could count on the police to destroy any union movement or anything else. And you had in your book, you describe Chief Parker, you bring it up through, but we go further, we go up to Darryl Gates, we go up to Rodney King. Well, first we had the Watts riot, uprising, I have to correct myself. That was the terminology of the establishment, that it was a riot. And then the Rodney King uprising. And now Black Lives Matter can be traced to, you know, I'm not claiming ownership by the LA people, but I've done these podcasts with Malina Abdullah and others who, you know, it's certainly one of the main originating points of the Black Lives Matter movement. And that brings me to a question I should have asked earlier, but I'll ask now. There's a tendency to celebrate the 60s as a very great crusading change time, and I accept all that. But it has occurred to me in this last 6-7 months that we are actually going through a much more profound time of change, and particularly in terms of America's most egregious problem of race. And my goodness, Black Lives Matter now has been embraced by a majority of the National Football League players and NBA and everything else. You know, I find the current time, the last 6 months for me, to be actually more exciting politically and more encouraging maybe than the 60s.
I have to agree. I've come to exactly the same conclusion. If you look at what Black Lives Matter accomplished in the past few months, this summer, ever since George Floyd was killed on Memorial Day weekend in Minneapolis, they have had demonstrations in everywhere in America, not just the big cities where there's, you know, majority minorities, but in all the little towns all over the place. I mean, my favorite example is Newport Beach had a Black Lives Matter march with a couple of hundred people. Now, you and I think of Newport Beach as the most wealthy white Republican place in Southern California. If there's Black Lives Matter in Newport Beach, something is happening in America. And the other thing I would point to is Black Lives Matter has actually had some impressive success, much more than we had at the time. I mean, when they started in L.A., our mayor was planning, it was publicly advocating to increase the budget of the LAPD by 6% after tens of thousands of people demonstrated in Pan Pacific Park. And then 1,000 people went to the mayor's house, he announced he had changed his mind and favored a cut of $150 million in the budget of the LAPD. Now, we say that's nowhere near enough. That's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, the whole idea of cutting the budget of the LAPD, this was unthinkable 6 months ago. And we have to give Black Lives Matter credit for keeping their eye on the ball, for organizing the right kind of pressure. And one reason they've been able to do this, I think, if we think, look at what happened to the left of our era. I speak with you as a older veteran of the 60s. The white part of the new left had bitter factional disputes. SDS famously split in 1969. One half expelled the other half. The black radical movement of the late 60s, the same kind of splits, even worse. It was led to the killing of two Black Panthers at UCLA at Campbell Hall in 1969 by two members of Ron Karenga's US organization. Yes, they had been kind of egged on by FBI COINTELPRO, but the factionalism, the splits really undermined the left of the 60s. Black Lives Matter has stayed together, kept focus, eye on the ball for, I think it's about 7 years now. I asked Malina Abdullah, how come they'd been able to do that? And she said that she thought one important reason was that Black Lives Matter is led by women. I wonder if you agree with that.
Well, yeah, I do agree with that, but I think it's not just, I shouldn't say not just, certainly women's leadership, but what you might also say is that they have the male ego in check. Yeah. And that there's a real sense of a community base, male and female, that this is a movement. Every time I've talked to people in that movement, including Malina, there's a sense of accountability. It isn't done for the media. It's not done for personal publicity, which, you know, your story of the 60s has a lot of egomaniacs running around.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I should be included in that. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, one of the things you could say about this movement is it's authentic now in a way that maybe the new left wasn't always, in the sense that it resonates with, first of all, it resonates right through the whole black community in America, small town, big town, rich, poor, what have you. There's an authenticity, and it's, you know, that's why you can have big celebrities, wealthy celebrities like LeBron James, principally involved, or Colin Kaepernick for that matter. But on the other hand, it's authentic because they're not in control. They're not setting it. And it's real to ordinary people. Why? Because they're telling them a reality they know all too well. They know the police forces are racist. They know the system is racist. They know you don't get a fair shake. And the problem, and I'm not going to put down the 60s rebellion because it was authentic to many people who were in the military, who were drafted. That's what made it successful. It was an authentic movement because it allied with not just Martin Luther King, but with John Lewis, with other people in, with the Black Panthers, with others, SNCC and what have you. So yes, the new left attained a great deal of legitimacy. But when it came, you know, the whole slogan of the whole world is watching, the whole idea of televised movement, that became its weakness. You know, and that anyone who could get on television could somehow define the movement. That has not happened here. Yes, famous black celebrities have spoken out, but they don't own the movement. The movement has is something that, as a historian, maybe you could analyze. But it has an authenticity for black people, but for white people, for brown people, there's something about it that they just can't. They're trying. President Trump is trying to smear it. Others are trying to smear it. It doesn't hold because there is something based in reality in this movement that maybe the new left didn't always have.
I think you're right. I think one of the things that we write about in our book on LA in the 60s is that there's a, especially looking at Black Los Angeles and what kind of political organizing and activist groups that were here. There's a clear historical trajectory with a sharp break around the Watts Rebellion in August of 1965. The Watts Rebellion was a huge shock to the mainstream media. It happened 1 week, exactly one. It started 1 week after LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That was the most far-reaching, the most important civil rights legislation, really, since the end of the Civil War. It enlisted the federal government in enforcing the right to vote for Black people in the states where they'd been denied the right to vote. We miss the Voting Rights Act right now. We need it. We still need it. We wish we had it back. Nevertheless, what people said was, well, the Black people have won. What are they complaining about? They got the Voting Rights Act. You know, the South is not going to be an all-white voting base anymore. But what the conventional wisdom in the mainstream media had missed was the specific history of the movement in L.A. L.A. had had a nonviolent, direct action protest movement that aimed to desegregate housing and the public schools, which started right in 1960, as I said earlier, inspired by the civil rights movement of the South, as we all were. LA had some of the strictest residential segregation anywhere in the United States, as strict as anything in the South. There were sit-ins, picket lines, building occupations at the new all-white suburbs, especially in Torrance, in the 63. And this movement succeeded in getting the state legislature of California to pass what was called an open housing law that banned some kinds of racial discrimination in housing. In 1964, the conservative real estate forces got a referendum on the ballot to repeal open housing in California, and two-thirds of white people voted in favor of the initiative to repeal public fair housing in California. That was really the end of the nonviolent direct action protest movement. 9 months after that, you get the Watts Rebellion. And then comes the period of Black radicalism, Black power, the rise of the Panthers, the rise of Ron Karenga's US organization, which have a very different conception of the intractability of white power and the need for a much more militant stance. So there is a clear trajectory here that really forced the Black community to confront the realities that white people were overwhelmingly against integration in Los Angeles. And that required a different kind of politics, which eventually, of course, collapsed, failed, and the era of the Panthers came to an end. You know a lot about this because you were in Berkeley. Oakland was the center of the Panthers.
Excuse me. It's not in your book, but I know a lot about it because as editor of Ramparts magazine, I was drawn before a grand jury investigating the Panthers in San Francisco and forced to testify challenging the government narrative, which wanted to, you know, demonize the whole movement.
And Eldridge Cleaver, who had been the presidential candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party in 1968, at least until he was ruled off the ballot, he was well known as a staff writer for Ramparts magazine, of which you were the editor.
Yes, but my point was, I want to get to some basic points because we're going to run out of time, and you are a font of knowledge about all this. So okay. I do want to go back to your book a little bit and draw some lessons for the present. First of all, I want to get into this thing of the old left, because you're very honest about it. And a lot of people have run away from that issue. But I just happened to go to a very good talk by a scholar, Taj Fraser, right now at USC, where I teach. And he's written a number of very important, very important book about China and its relation to the civil rights movement, communist China. He's written about Paul Robeson, that earlier period. So it's fresh in my mind. And everybody forgets that one of the results of red baiting and the Cold War and everything was to destroy, in the name of anti-communism, to destroy probably the most effective movement to support civil rights for Black people in this country, which had white support as well. And those whites were red-baited, and some of them were reds. Dorothy Healey would be one. But a caricature was developed. J. Edgar Hoover used it famously to try to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, because two of his top assistants that he relied on had come out of that earlier civil rights movement, one Black and one white. And Hoover was going to use that to blackmail him. But the fact is, this is a history that very few people want to touch. It's kind of the third rail. But the communists on the West Coast particularly, where you had the Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union led by Harry Bridges, who was attacked, you know, as being a communist. He's originally from Australia. They were very strong in Southern California and Northern California. But in Southern California, when you talk about that earlier pro-civil rights activity, they were one of the first unions to really take on the racism within the labor movement. You know, and whereas the longshoremen on the East Coast were all involved with the mob and were quite reactionary in that respect. In Los Angeles, you had a very progressive, and you did in Northern California, labor movement. And it wasn't just the longshore, but they were a very powerful union, because ships in those days had to be unloaded by hand and, you know, wagon. And so they were very important. You even had with the United Auto Workers, you have somebody who's in your book, Paul Schrade, who was one of the first labor leaders to turn against the war very early, and yet he was representing workers working in the aerospace industry. So a large part of what's left out of the whole 60s discussion, and this goes for people involved in rock groups like Country Joe and others. I remember a guy from my neighborhood in the Bronx, Peanuts Cone, had come out and had one of the first big music sites in Los Angeles. They were not divorced from that left. It gave them an organizational strength. It gave them an older base of people to support. And I think that helped characterize that period. You also had the people in the film industry who had been damaged by the loyalty oath and everything, and who were sympathetic to these younger people now challenging the status quo.
One small fact that tells you a lot about the old left in Los Angeles: Dorothy Healey had been put on trial. The Smith Act trials, where being a member of the Communist Party was officially a crime, and leaders of the party were put on trial in the late 50s. They eventually won their case. It's on constitutional grounds, but Dorothy Healey ran for county tax assessor in Los Angeles in 1966 and got 85,000 votes. It just seems unbelievable today. 85,000 votes for Dorothy Healey in 1966 in LA County. And that shows that at least some of the old left really had a lot of support, which they didn't have in other big cities, especially in the East.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Well, as long as we're on this theme, let me just point out something about L.A. history. I guess it's about 55 years ago or a little bit longer is when the L.A. Lakers came here from Minneapolis. And at that time, there was an understanding in the NBA that you could only have two starting members of your team who were Black. People ignore that, but documented fact of sports history. You also had when Tom Bradley was our first Black mayor. I remember I interviewed him on his 60th birthday for the Los Angeles Times, and he told me that much of his adult life he'd had trouble even checking into motels or hotels. He had to check whether, in fact, they would accept or make black people feel welcome, even though he had been a member of the L.A. Police Department, an officer. And yet, you know, he was going to be challenged. You had in both Northern and Southern California restrictions against blacks being salesmen in auto showrooms or being working on the front desk in the fancier hotels. So to echo your point before about discrimination in housing, the 60s were a reaction to the 50s and what had come before, where a polite form, or a cover-up of racism was actually quite normal in both Southern and Northern California.
And Tom Bradley is an important part of the story that we tell because he was famously became the first black mayor, not just in Los Angeles, but nationally. Well, second, I guess, Cleveland, what was his name? Stokes?
Yeah.
Was the first big city black mayor. But Los Angeles, much more important place. We were especially interested in he had been a captain of the LAPD and then a city councilman representing the Crenshaw district, which was an integrated district in the 60s, Japanese, Jewish voters, and African Americans. In 1969, he ran a really inspiring grassroots campaign for mayor that had a lot of support on the west side of L.A. Sam Yorty, the incumbent, a very right-wing, pro-war and racist Democrat of the old kind of establishment Democrat of the old school, ran a openly racist campaign relying on turning out the white vote in the San Fernando Valley and ended up defeating him in 1969. 4 years later, he ran again and won, became LA's first black mayor. That was unfortunately, from our point of view, that was a very different kind of campaign. It was not a grassroots campaign. It was run by professionals with a lot of downtown business and corporate support. But that marks an important turning point in the history of Los Angeles as well. Bradley, of course, ended up not really doing a whole lot for black Los Angeles, but he led the redevelopment of downtown, and he never got the LAPD under control. So that was a very kind of compromised victory, but still one that we need to mark and notice.
Well, he did have Darryl Gates fired. Stanley Sheinbaum, who was the head of the police commission appointed by Tom Bradley. That was an important event, right? After Rodney King, when Darryl Gates, the police chief, defended the chokehold killing black people because they had a different physiology. And that took some courage to fire him. I don't think other mayors had anything done. I'm just throwing that one in.
Oh, no, absolutely. That was let's remember, Darryl Gates had started out as the driver for the kind of creator of the modern LA Police Department, Bill Parker. So there was kind of a direct line of succession from the racist founding of the modern LAP down through Darryl Gates. But yes, getting rid of Darryl Gates was a key turning point in the history of Los Angeles. And we thank Stanley Sheinbaum for taking the lead in pushing for that.
Yeah, and just to indicate the crazy quilt of L.A. culture, he was married to a wonderful woman, Betty Warner Sheinbaum, who was the daughter of Harry Warner, along with Jack Warner, were the heads of the whole movie industry at one point. So L.A. has been full of these contradictions. I do want to make one point, self-serving as it may be, I want to refer you to page 177 of your book.
Right.
And it's interesting. The one movement that has had the most incredible success in such a short period is the gay liberation. And I was reminded in reading your book that gay liberation came very late as a cause embraced by the 60s revolution or whatever it was. I was reminded of that fact when I came across my own name in your book.
It's on page 177.
Yes, you're right. I marked it down. And what reminded me, because I went to work for the LA Times about 6 years later, after that incident, but that when and I was there during the whole AIDS pandemic, and the LA Times still would not treat AIDS when Reagan was president as an emerging issue. It was bad enough that the president was denying and would not use it, but the newspaper was not covering it. And we had, you know, this is beyond the realm of your book, but it just reminded me, but in your book, you go into the original Gay Liberation Front, and we had later the Madison Society and everything. But given the enormous success of that movement in recent years, it's a good reminder of how difficult it was for gay people in Hollywood, in L.A. at that time.
And one of the most striking stories in our book is the story of the beginnings of a public, open gay liberation movement. More than 2 years, we think of Stonewall as the beginning of everything in gay politics in America. But really, L.A. was 2 years before Stonewall. L.A. had the first ever public street demonstration opposing police raids on gay bars. This was at the Black Cat Tavern on Sunset Boulevard in Echo Park. They'd been raided, you know, cops were always raiding the gay bars on New Year's Eve of 1969. 12 men were arrested. The crime, kissing at midnight on New Year's Eve. They organized the street protest a month or two after that and made history. One of the important things about why, and LA then developed the first national gay newspaper, The Advocate, was based in Los Angeles today, the largest gay publication in America, the largest gay institution in the world. The gay church was began in LA with Reverend Troy Davis. A lot of this happened in, and the New Left part of it, the anti-war part, the, as you say, the Gay Liberation Front. A lot of this.
By the way, I just want to, sorry, not to nitpick, but I don't think you gave credit to the Madison Society.
Earlier, you're quite right. Please tell us about the Madison Society.
Well, it was one of the first openly gay organizations, and it published a publication called One. And I know it was in the 60s because I was working at City Lights Books in San Francisco when the guy who was running it would bring in, you know, maybe 20 copies of the publication. I only bring it up because people forget how dismal the situation was for gay people in America. It was now a whole generation has come where there have been victories and normalization and so forth. But you know, going back to, and I was in L.A. quite a bit during that period, and as you point out in your book, I actually ran for the Senate at that time, a kind of forlorn campaign, but I did, the Gay Liberation Front wrote my part of my platform, and I remember having more resistance to that from a lot of supposedly well-meaning white people than I did for supporting the Black Panthers. Or supporting SNCC. I mean, that went really right up through the whole AIDS crisis. So if we want to celebrate some really remarkable turnaround, the attitude towards gay people in this country, now many of them are white and they're in everybody's family, et cetera, but boy, that was a movement that had a hard time getting going.
And I'm glad you mentioned the Madison Society, because the Madison Society was founded by old left organizers who'd been kicked out of the Communist Party. Dorothy Healy later said she regretted this, but the party line was you couldn't be gay in the Communist Party because you'd be vulnerable to blackmail by the FBI. So they were all kicked out at one point.
That was the U.S. government's excuse for kicking them out of the State Department. Yes. And not letting them be in the military.
Yes. Yeah. So the In L.A., some very talented gay organizers kicked out of the Communist Party by Dorothy Healy organized the Madison Society using some of the same underground techniques as the communists had used in building the Communist Party. And you're quite right. They were the first. Of course, the New Left part, the Gay Liberation front denounced them for being, you know, conservative and integrationist and not revolutionary enough. But that was the 60s.
Yeah. Okay, so let me wrap this up with you. Why should people read this book?
Well, I think there's a history here that makes it clear how important LA has been in shaping the political world that we know today. I don't think you need to read about the 60s to get the lessons that Black Lives Matter needs today. As we have seen, Black Lives Matter is doing a lot better than we did. Part of the thing you understand when you read about the 60s is why it is that the Black Lives Matter movement has been so much more successful, is so much more effective, has so much broader support. The things that they do that we did not do. Nevertheless, the roots of so much of our present world are found there. We've talked about the gay liberation movement, the women's liberation movement, the anti-war movement. We've talked about how you can appreciate how much America, and in particular, how much Los Angeles has changed, and what remains to be done. I mean, the fact is that Blacks in 1960 were largely excluded from the decent jobs, the decent working class jobs in Los Angeles. That's still very much the case. If you look at the demands raised in the high school blowouts in South LA and East LA, they demanded smaller class size in public schools. They demanded more school counselors. These are exactly the same demands that were raised in the teachers' union strike, when was it? Last year. So you also get a sense of all the problems that remain that were first fought about in the 60s and that we're still fighting about today. And, you know, it's a sobering thought, but it's an important part of the struggles going on in the streets, you know, this week.
Well, let me pitch your book a little better than you're just doing.
Well, I'd appreciate that.
Maybe I'm fresh. I'm a little bit angry with it because it's kept me up a few nights trying to get through it. Not that the writing isn't great and the stories. I really do object to 800-page books. Even if you cut out the index, it still comes to what? No,
I'm 640. 640.
But let me tell you, it's a very good bedside reader to return to. And it does carry... We're talking about Black Lives Matter. We're talking about a situation in our country now where there seems to be a national reckoning. There seems to be a new attitude. We have to solve these problems. But Set the Night on Fire, this excellent book by Mike Davis and John Wiener, L.A. in the 60s, is an incredibly well-documented, beautifully written book that reminds you of the capacity of the establishment of this society. And the establishment comes in a lot of different dresses, you know, Republican Party, Democratic Party, do-gooders, whatever. There are lots of different, you know, church establishment, I don't mean Senator Church, I mean, you know, official big churches. There's a lot of co-option. And there's also a lot of repression, okay? The 60s broke the basic backbone of the 60s, whether it was cultural or political, and both often merged, was broken by deceit, by barbarism, by killing people, setting one against another, framing people, imprisoning a lot of people. But it was also destroyed by seduction, by co-opting people. I had an example of that today, and I don't want to prejudge it, but it's why I want to get to that a little bit now. I read a story today. We've had, it was in the New York Times. We're doing this, I don't know, what is today? The 14th, so people can look it up, the 14th of September. It was an article about how wealthy people, particularly Soros being one who gave a couple of $100,000 in support of efforts to deal with racism now in America, $200 million. And then the Sanders Foundation, which is one that caught my eye this morning, I think they've given $250 million, and they're giving it to a whole bunch of organizations. And at first glance, it looked like a really good thing. And then I started questioning it, because after all, who were the Sanders? They're dead now, but their daughter seems a well-intentioned person, runs the foundation along with her husband. And I read this story. And what the story was, really, in, when you read the fine print, is that money, this huge pledge of money to address this basic question of racial oppression beyond inequality in America, is given to a whole host of groups. Now, many of them are probably wonderful, but it caught my idea. Why is John Podesta's organization, you know, the New America Project, why are they getting a big chunk of the money? And I linked it back. Who were the Sanders? Now, of course, the Rockefellers and other people, their heirs ended up using money in good ways. So was the Ford Foundation. I'm not going to deny that. But the fact is, the Sanders made their money from the savings and loan scandals, you know, the which preceded the big banking meltdown of the last decade. And the people who were, some of the people getting money, they're very much connected with the Democratic Party establishment and getting out the votes for the Democratic Party, which in this season, I suspect, one could defend. But I wonder if we're not again witnessing co-option. And we had it before. We've seen how the image of Martin Luther King has been co-opted. He's now a wonderful, benign figure. He wasn't. He was a radical figure. And he died saying that if you don't address the problem of poor people, you're not addressing the problem of people, of black people or anyone else in this country who's suffering. He's also died a year after, assassinated a year after pronouncing the U.S. government as the major purveyor of violence in the world and coming at it strongly against the war in Vietnam. So I want to ask you, as a historian now, and John Wiener's a major historian, American historian, UC, University of California, Irvine, legendary historian, really. And I want to ask you, what about co-option of the current moment? It seems like the movement for change has gotten a great engine in it now. And I really respect what leading celebrities are doing, as well as, of course, grassroots people even more. But isn't your book really about how a movement was smashed, co-opted, bought off, intimidated, set against itself and everything? And aren't you, as a historian, concerned that there will be a repeat right now?
I think you point to a very important problem that we are going to face after Biden wins. I mean, right now it's kind of all hands on deck, repress the political differences between the progressives and the party establishment of the Democrats to get Biden elected big. But the day after that happens, and especially the day after January 20th, when, God willing, Biden will take the oath of office, we are going to have to be pressing that Democratic establishment with the progressive agenda. And, you know, they don't really want to do it. And there's a lot of forces that are going to tell us, don't rock the boat. You know, America's a very precarious place right now, and you have to restrain yourself, and we can't do everything that you want to do. Right now, we've got to get Biden elected. I think a very good way to get Biden elected is to advance the progressive agenda. But Biden himself is definitely not going to do it. This is not where he comes from. We know this very well. So we have to maintain our political ideals, our political coherence, and our political organizations to make sure that our kind of progressive politics, which is really the only thing that it has a chance of changing what has got to be changed in America today, to make sure that that has a chance of succeeding under a Biden presidency. Because if Biden fails, I hate to think of what would come next.
Well, but what comes next comes because of the failure of Democrats. After
yes.
all, Richard Nixon
yes.
Came after 8 years of rule by Democrats,
yes.
John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And we had Barack Obama and we got Donald Trump. And I want to end this by basically not challenging, but raising a question about set the night on fire L.A. in the 60s. Mike Davis and John Wiener. It's a Verso book. They publish great books. You should buy it just to support good publishing, which is a dying art. But, you know, the relevance of this book is that here were you, it was probably the most vibrant period of modern American history in terms of political dissent, challenging, etc., on every level. Challenging empire, challenging racism, challenging male hegemony. You can go down the whole list. And yet, it was basically co-opted, crushed, divided, and a lot of people got hurt. They got hurt at the end of a billy club. They got hurt by being thrown in jail. They got hurt by not being able to work in their professions anymore, by being blacklisted. And one of the great casualties of that period, of course, was Martin Luther King, our government went out to destroy, as it really went out to destroy the civil rights movement, having any edge at all, despite all the great celebration of the Civil Rights Act and everything. The fact is, when the civil rights movement started paying attention to poor black people as well as poor white people and really trying to deal with systemic racism, it got crushed. And it got crushed, yes, you can blame J. Edgar Hoover and the top people in the FBI, but the President of the United States could control that FBI. So could his Attorney General, which at one point was Bobby Kennedy. The President of the United States was John Kennedy and then Lyndon Johnson for most of this period you're talking about, the 60s. And the damage to people protesting to a social movement that you're describing in the 60s came primarily from the very Democrats that we look to for our salvation. Where does that leave you?
That leaves me that we have to maintain a coherent and distinct progressive left that's... you know, indispensable if America's going to survive as a democracy, and if we're going to address the climate crisis and the original sin of slavery and its heir racism in America today, we're going to need a coherent and powerful progressive movement that can fight in the Biden years for the changes that America needs.
All right, but okay, as a historian, let me ask you one other question. The very model of our society and the presumption of even people on the left has been, as flawed as it is, we have the model of the good society. We're a work in progress, but basically, even those of us on the left, many of us during much of this period, much of our history, have actually accepted a notion of American exceptionalism. Many of us are the children of immigrants. We bought into the siren song of American exceptionalism. And isn't really the lesson of this current period is that we don't necessarily have the key model and answers, heretical as it may be to assert. How come we're doing worse with this pandemic than just about every other country in the world? How come our healthcare system turned out to be adequate? How come our management of environmental concerns, including climate change, have turned out to be disastrous, no matter who's president? Maybe the problem is with the capitalist component of democratic capitalism. Is that possible?
I think that's possible. I think you're onto something there.
Well, I mean, it's something nobody wants to say. Maybe what's rotten here is not, you know, the intricacies of checks and balances and, yes, this wonderful Bill of Rights we have and so forth, but that when money can overpower everything, by logic, greed overpowers everything. You don't have sensible adults watching the store, or we wouldn't have had segregation. You know, we wouldn't have had slavery. And we certainly would have made greater progress since the Civil War than we have. Maybe we failed to do these things because this model we have of a rapacious capitalism, which has nothing to do with Adam Smith and everything to do with the political capture of the political system by money, a total denial of Adam Smith. Maybe that's the real enemy. And I don't hear Democrats talking any more convincingly about changing that than Republicans. And in fact, it was Bill Clinton who basically unleashed the greed of Wall Street, which has brought so much misery and laid the foundation for Trump in that misery.
We are together on this, and one of the things that we hope to show in our book, Set the Night on Fire, L.A. in the 60s, is how ordinary people, especially young people, can provide a tremendous heart, tremendous courage, tremendous passion, and tremendous organizing to a movement to bring fundamental change to America. They were defeated in the 60s. We need to try again.
Okay, well, I think that's a good positive point on which to end, and I happen to agree with you on that. I remain optimistic because clearly when the system is not functioning, the center, under any rules of logic, should not be able to hold, and we see that. We see that. I'm doing this recording with you at a time when California is burning, when we've had terrible racially inspired violence, including in liberal blue states like California and Oregon and Washington and so forth. And so I want to thank you. The book is Set the Night on Fire, LA in the 60s, two brilliant authors, Mike Davis and John Wiener. And I've taken little quib shots at it, but it's a great book. And frankly, the length makes it better reading, because it's in the texture, it's in the detail, and you need to have that detail. So that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Natasha Hakimi Zapata is the person who writes the intro. Christopher Ho at KCRW-FM in Santa Monica does the engineering and gets us up on the site. Joshua Shear is the show's producer, and Lucy Berbio does the transcription. We are helped very much by the JWK Foundation with an award of some funding in memory of Gene Stein, who knew everything that John Wiener and I have been talking about, and both of us learned from her much about how the society works, just as a personal footnote. So a memory of Gene Stein. I say goodbye to you, John. Thanks for doing this.
Bob, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you, and see you next week. Rien de rien.